And NASA, among other organizations, is trying to keep track of all of the near-Earth objects. That really means objects that have the capability of some number of zillions of years from now potentially hitting the Earth. And if we detected one of those is going to hit the Earth, let's say 70 years from now, and those kind of predictions are very possible, what would we do about it is a damn interesting question. We've already discussed that putting a nuclear bomb alongside of it and exploding it might not be a solution. W-Roy, K2RIW.
Yes, indeed. The only people who have answers for this problem are based in Hollywood, and it doesn't work in real life. So I don't know if anyone has the faintest clue of how to deal with it, and I'm not as optimistic as you are about predictions. A lot of times, smaller meteorites have kind of snuck up on us completely in surprise to us. So I hope that we get far better being able to predict these things. And I equally hope that we figure out some incredible way to get rid of them. I mean, you pretty much, you can't just blow it up, even if you could blow it up, because you'd be stuck with the same momentum. So if it was pointed at you before you blew it up, chances are most of those little bits and pieces are equally going to be pointed at you. So you almost have to invent yet another propellant engine to get it to move someplace else. And it's kind of difficult to do it when the masses are in the megatons.
The biggest determining factor of whether or not a meteor becomes a meteorite, does it go all the way through the atmosphere, strike the Earth, and do a whole lot of damage, is a function of how big the chunk is when it starts out. So if you can break it up into smaller pieces, you could get all those smaller pieces burning up in the atmosphere and not doing very much damage. So breaking it up is a possible approach, but like you said, Hollywood has got their ways of doing it. Real science, maybe not. Or at least not yet. K2RIW.
Well, it's something to keep researchers busy and active and with salaries. So I wish them great luck because inevitably, it's only a matter of time. I mean, if you look at the geological data, it's not if, it's just when. I mean, if we're very lucky, it won't be for millions of years, and it'll be some other group of individuals' problem, not ours. But it's only going to be a matter of when.
You seem to say we don't have an insurance policy that keeps a space junk from hitting the Earth. Comets, meteorites, asteroids, comets and asteroids, and small planets and whatever, passing suns. Can't buy that insurance policy. Oh well, take you high.
Now, there was a great episode of the original Star Trek television show, which had a planet that actually had a shield device that protected it from incoming astronomical objects. So, you know, maybe someday we'll invent one of those things. You never know.
If you can detect it early enough and give it a slight push, it's like the butterfly effect. It can make a huge difference in the effect downrange. And there are ways when you can, in some cases, detect it long before. That meteor that did a lot of damage in Russia a few years ago, it wasn't very large, and it came from the direction of the sun. That's the reason why it had not been detected ahead of time and predicted. And it created an awful big shockwave that blew out a lot of windows. And an awful lot of people got injured by all that flying glass. K2RIW.
Yeah, the farther away it is when you discover it that you can get to it eventually, and the smaller its mass, the better your chances of nudging it. Now, there are some meteor, you know, the one that is part of what caused the dinosaurs to die out. I think that would require more than a little nudging. That was a rather big rock. But, yeah, that's the idea so far, unless someone comes up with a brighter idea.
And I believe they think that rock hit near the Yucatan Peninsula and creates a great big hole under the water in that area. Is that true, Roy?
Yeah, there's a very big gorge in that area, and there's a deposit of iridium, which is kind of known to be in meteors, that kind of coated it and coated a lot of geographical strata across the world. The plume just kind of spread out and settled down. So you can actually, in some areas, tap away at the stone until you find the small iridium band.
That told us how long ago it took place, roughly 65 million years ago. And I believe that was the fifth, number five, mass extinction on planet Earth. Correct me if I'm wrong on that one, Roy, KQIW.
Yes, it's noted to be the fifth. But, you know, scientists being scientists are not quite sure what caused it. They think it's not quite 100% from the meteor. They sort of, at this point, I get the feeling that they think it was a perfect storm of a bunch of situations in which the meteor certainly didn't help at all. It certainly put a dent in things, and there are rocks like that still out there, unfortunately. So beware, and what can I tell you? Just keep on working on the problem, guys.
WS to it.
Yes, Paul.
The most interesting statement I ever heard about that rock was the size, and they said it was 6 miles, possibly 6 miles in diameter, which means that when it was hitting the ocean, the top part of that rock was still up around where the jets fly, and the jets fly at 30,000-35,000 feet, so that gives you an idea how big this rock was. Massive.
It's sort of incredible. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine. The whole planet must have shuddered.
My understanding is it created a huge so-called nuclear winter. In other words, it put such a tremendous amount of dust into the atmosphere that the sunlight could no longer get to the atmosphere to grow the plants. Therefore, most plants died, and the dinosaurs starved. They had nothing to eat. KQRW.
Yeah, but that was kind of the favorite story that the scientists told around 15, 20 years ago. They did further dating, and I think they've come to some conclusion that the actual extinction event of these animals happened tens and hundreds of thousands of years after that. So, it sounded good when I heard it, but right now, this week, they've decided that it was a more complex situation that involves the meteor, but begin and end with the meteor. So, who knows? I'm sure they'll find more rocks and come to more conclusions, and we'll learn a little bit more every so often.
So, instead, was all of that extinction due to global heating, global freezing? If it wasn't the nuclear winter of that meteor, then what else can create the death of almost everything on Earth? That's a hard one to explain, as I see it.
Well, you always have climatic changes as well, and sometimes they equilibrate nicely, and other times they go a little bit too far one end or the other. You know, if we had a kind of a winter that got set up at the very start of the meteor shower and such, it may have just gotten worse and worse as time went on, and before you know it, the entire world was packed in ice, and only very small creatures that could just barely survive and creatures under the water could barely survive. I mean, the biggest thing that caused an incredible amount of death, you wouldn't believe it now, was when plants first started to do photosynthesis, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, in this anaerobic world that bacteria had been living and enjoying, they were flooded with this noxious oxygen that killed it. And to this day, anaerobic bacteria really do not like oxygen. They much prefer a oxygen-free environment. So all kinds of interesting things can cause life to die. You know, what paved the way for us kind of did away a whole bunch of bacteria.
One of the things you mentioned was an ice age, Roy. And for an ice age to happen, a significant percentage of the Earth must suddenly start operating at a lower temperature. If you measured the thermal time constant of this very massive object called Earth, I don't know what the number is, but I bet you it's millions of years as a thermal time constant. It takes a long time to cool off a substantial portion of the Earth. And even during the ice age, near the poles you had ice. Near the equator, I don't think you ever had ice. So that all the life, all it's got to do is move towards the equator and it can keep right on going. So that in itself doesn't seem to explain a major mass extinction of the Roy K2RIW.
Well, again, it was probably a perfect storm of a whole bunch of things, but it's just like the sunspot cycle is 11 years to us because we've been measuring it for a couple of centuries. You don't really know if there are kind of circles within circles and cycles within cycles. The regular ice ages that we've been able to map geographically over the last 100,000 years. You can't really extrapolate if there are wider cycles where everything freezes up. I mean, there's a certain amount of heat generated from the Earth because it basically has a radioactive core. It has uranium and it has thorium, and that gives off heat, and there are other factors that give off heat on the Earth, and you have the sun above. But I don't know what the details would turn out to be, but... Usually, cold with the raising of dust from the meteorite, plus other kind of biological avalanches that all these things kind of led to, is what scientists kind of ponder as possible causes. No one has the definitive answer yet, so there's always a place for a Nobel Prize out there.
I believe there's a strong amount of evidence for the nuclear winter. In the case of a nuclear winter, like we blasted off a whole lot of nuclear devices, or this meteorite is the equivalent of a billion megaton bombs, that's going to put so much junk into the atmosphere that the sunlight doesn't get through anymore. Since meteorites tend to have a lot of iridium, and since almost worldwide you can find this iridium layer at roughly 65 million years ago, that's strong evidence that the two are related. The iridium, the meteor, nuclear winter, and mass extinction. I suspect that that's going to come back into a lively theory if it's going through a period of not so well accepted right now. There's too many pieces of evidence that hang together on that one. K2RIW.
I'm a big proponent of Occam's razor. The simplest answer is usually the best. But usually when these things kind of settle down, there's always a little complication around the edges. It's very difficult to have them come down to a very simple, fundamental concept that supplies the entire answer. But who knows? We may see, or we'll certainly see. The pendulum swings to and fro when it comes to all kinds of theories. What is held in high regard today might be not so high regard in 5 to 10 years. I mean, like I mentioned, the origin of the asteroid belt was thought to be something different. So you never know. We'll find out, and hopefully we'll all be here, and I'll report on that as well.
KNH.
Yes, I've just been sitting back listening, enjoying the conversation. Has there ever been any thought given to the size of a tsunami with that kind of an impact, like a worldwide tsunami type of an event?
Well, you'd sort of have to explain that what would be the phenomena that would bring that into action. I mean, you need to have a kind of a physical disturbance that would generate such an incredible thing.
Well, that's going right back to the asteroid that took out all life or, created the extinction of the dinosaurs. If there was enough impact or three-quarters of the world was covered in ocean, what would it take to cover the planet in water?
Okay, so that would explain animals. Wouldn't explain the extinction of the water animals.
Well, I would think they would survive. I mean, there is deep, deep water, but, you know, like mankind is mostly settled along the coast, I'm sure animals are the same way.
Well, you know, animals kind of find their niches all over the place. We tend to like coastlines because they make it easy for transporting goods and services around. But you have animals that prefer desert surroundings. You have animals that thrive in the Arctic. That's the beauty of life. Life finds niche almost everywhere.
Careful now on water animals. As I see it, Roy, you would think that a nuclear winter affects surface plants and animals, without a doubt. When you get a whole lot of junk in the atmosphere so the sunlight can't get through, the plants die, the animals that eat the plants, they die. The ocean animals, they also need sunlight. That sunlight illuminates the surface, gives you a whole lot of krill, and that begins the bottom of the food chain. So you deny the ocean a whole lot of sunlight. Where is the food going to come from that feeds all those animals? If you do it for the next million years, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
B2FIU. I agree with you entirely, Dick. Matter of fact, most of the oxygen production on this planet, people kind of believe that it's trees and forests, but the overwhelming majority of the oxygen is created in the ocean. The sunlight would impact on the water. The tsunami wouldn't particularly impact much on the water animals, but a decrease in the amount of sun getting to the surface would certainly have an effect.
B2FIU.
Yes, George.
There isn't much sunlight in the absolute depths of the ocean, and many, many, many deep spots of the ocean, there is no sunlight at all. And there is a tremendous amount of life there.
Yes, George, but they tend to depend upon sources for their food supply. At the very surface, you have algae, simple single-cell and multi-cell algae. You have plankton and such that eat the algae. You have fish that eat the plankton. And you have other fish lower down that eat the poor fish that ate the plankton. So there's a chain. There is a small branch called extremophiles, which live near a geyser type of vent in the bottom of the ocean that feed off of sulfur chemicals and such. They derive energy through breaking down the high energy compounds that are given off in there, and then those bacteria are again eaten by the local animals that can't live in can't metabolize sulfates and such. So it all comes back to the sun, except for the extremophiles, because there's always an exception to any rule.
What were the first, I can't think of the name, Philo something, early in before even rearrangements of surfaces of the earth, there were billions of them, which were known to be the first form of life. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
You think you're alluding to trilobites?
One of the forms, yes. And there was even, yes, correct. And there was one even earlier than that, before the surfaces of the Earth were rearranged by, of course, the Earth's internal desire to do so. First forms of life, period. Now, this all started in the bottoms and the depths of the ocean. And yes, correct, the sun has an effect with it downward, but it starts without sunlight.
Well, you know, what can I tell you? You can take your bet, and there's no definitive answer for what the first life is. There's a lot of good theories. There's the guy who put a bunch of precursors in a jar and gave a couple electric sparks to it and came out with organic chemistry molecules. But trilobites, although fascinating, are not the first form of life. Life began as very simple single-celled organisms. And they were, as I said before, they were anaerobic. They didn't even have the ability to use oxygen as fuel. So they would just consume high-energy molecules that happened to swim by in the ocean and suffer through it. It took a long time before there was photosynthesis producing oxygen and little organelles that were able to metabolize and extract energy using oxygen. And then first they had to develop multicellular organisms. And way, way down the line, you have things like trilobites, which are rather sophisticated multicellular organ systems. They simply were all over the place and left such pretty fossils that everyone has seen a trilobite fossil.
Hey, thanks. I'm glad I started something. KD2FIU.
Participation is always a good thing. It's never a bad thing. So, George, whenever you have any points of reference or questions or comments, feel free. Okay. Another study regarding coffee consumption. Some studies suggest that it cures you of your ills. Others nudges you in the direction of causing your ills. It's great for you in some studies. It's poison in others. What is a researcher to do? Personally, I think it's mostly a matter of all things in moderation. A little coffee with a little caffeine can act as a mild stimulant to your central nervous system and make it a bit easier to focus your mind on a problem. Too much and you might get a little edgy, a little tremulous, and unable to hold a single thought for more than a second. Here's the thing about coffee. There really has never been much scientific debate about whether it's healthy. People have been concerned about the effects of coffee since the 16th century. But as long as we've been analyzing its effects, we've observed that drinking coffee tends to improve your health, not harm it. In moderation, of course. Now, let me drop. Recently, another of these giant studies came out, this time looking at residents of the United Kingdom. Researchers wanted to examine how coffee habits affect overall health, as measured by a statistic called the all-cause mortality. It basically means that they grouped people by how many cups of coffee they drank per day, then looked to see whether these groups that consumed more cups had more deaths during the course of the study. If the cohort that drank 8 cups per day had fewer deaths than the group that drank 2, that would imply that somehow the high-volume coffee drinkers were healthier. That's exactly what they did and what they found. Across 502,000 participants ranging from the age of 38 to 73, both male and female, the more coffee a person drank, the less likely they were to die. The researchers published their results in the Journal of American Medical Association, Internal Medicine, last Monday. The difference weren't giant, but they were statistically significant. When doing a large observational study like this, researchers use a hazard ratio to measure how much of an effect a variable like coffee consumption has. Let me drop. For example, in the case of a hazard ratio of 1 means that no difference in how often people die, whereas a hazard ratio of, say, 0.5 would mean that the group that drank coffee died only half as often as the non-coffee drinkers. This study grouped participants into 6 cohorts, those who drank less than 1, 2 to 3, 4 to 5, 6 and 6 to 7, and more than 8 cups of coffee per day. The researchers found that the hazard ratio generally declined as the number of cups consumed increased, indicating that the more coffee people drank, the less likely they were to die during a set period. All but the first ratio was considered statistically significant, meaning that the difference between the groups was profound enough to probably be more than random chance. Let me drop. Studies like this can only ever tell us what health outcomes tend to look like for people who drink coffee. They're observational. No one has assigned groups of participants to groups of participants to drink 5 or 2 or 0 cups per day and then make sure that their lives are otherwise identical. So they can't provide any real causation. But because we're never going to run a clinical trial in which coffee gets prescribed, observational studies are the closest we'll ever get. That's why it's important to gather a lot of people, hundreds of thousands or even millions are ideal, so that you can be assured that your findings aren't just statistical flukes. Drinking coffee may be associated with a lot of other habits that influence health, or perhaps not drinking coffee is associated with something. Let me drop. For instance, people who have serious illnesses like cancer may not drink coffee, but these people are also more likely to die. That would artificially increase the mortality of the non-coffee drinking group. The researchers in this study looked to see which other traits were associated with drinking lots or no coffee. Things like smoking, body weight, socioeconomic status, and so on. And tried to control for those factors to prevent them from interfering with the results. Coffee drinkers tended to be male and white, for example, and also drank more alcohol and were former smokers. Particularly high coffee consumption was correlated with being a current smoker. Drinking between 1 and 3 cups correlated with having a university degree and being older, and as well as reporting excellent health. Let me drop. All these findings generally line up with what other large-scale studies have found. Drinking more coffee tends to correlate with good health and fewer deaths. There is a 2017 European study showing that with 521,000 people. There's one from 2012 involving more than 5 million Americans finding the same inverse correlation. And there's another one from 2017 focusing on non-white populations in the U.S., still finding that drinking coffee is generally associated with lower risk of death. This study is, for the most part, the same as the rest, except for one thing. It looked at genetic variations in caffeine metabolism. Let me drop. Relatively recent work has established certain mutations that make a person respond to caffeine in different ways. Researchers think this may be partly explaining why some people can down a cappuccino after dinner and sleep fine, whereas others have to stop drinking after 4 p.m. The United Kingdom researchers used a large database containing genetic information about participants to test whether certain variants correlated with better or worse health outcomes. Perhaps those who respond quickly and easily to caffeine would fare worse. They just weren't sure, but even looking across 400,000 people with whom genetic data was available, the researchers found no difference in the outcome between those whose genes predisposed them to caffeine sensitivity and those who didn't. That is, across genetic variants, those who drank more coffee tended to have lower risk of death. Let me drop. They did find, somewhat surprisingly, that those with higher caffeine metabolism scores, those who metabolize caffeine faster, tended to drink more coffee. Surprise, surprise. If you're one of those people who can't have more than a cup without getting jittery, but you still want to drink coffee, don't worry. You can drink decaf and still get the health benefits. The study, like others, found that the caffeine content seemed to make no difference to the risk of death. Even instant coffee seems to work. Although the researchers noted that the association for ground caffeine coffee were generally stronger, researchers aren't sure what in coffee it is that seems to boost our health, if it boosts it at all. But the scientists on the study noted it provides further evidence that the secret ingredient isn't caffeine. It may be one of many antioxidant-rich compounds in the morning. Let me drop. One 2005 study in JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association, suggested that it could be compounds that reduce inflammation and insulin resistance, like lignans and quinines and magnesium. Of course, none of this means that coffee isn't an addictive substance, that pregnant women shouldn't be chugging it. Caffeine is a stimulant, and too much depends on your personal metabolism. An overload can give you headaches, irritability, restlessness, a fast heartbeat, and muscle tremors. Plus, it can deprive you of sleep. Health recommends limiting yourself to 400 milligrams a day for that reason. It also doesn't mean put oodles of sugar and cream in without having any negative health effects, like obesity or heart disease. But it does mean that the average person can drink their moderately sugared, lightly creamed coffee in peace. So all things in moderation. Let me drop for questions or comments.
Golf X-ray Mike?
Yes, Golf X-ray Mike.
Bravo 2 Golf X-ray Mike, this is Rich. Isn't there, wasn't there some study that suggested that one or two cups of coffee was actually beneficial for the heart? Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-ray Mike.
Well, again, like all of these others, unfortunately, they're not double-blind tests, so it's very difficult. It's more of a statistical finding. You gather a large group of people, you ask them a whole story questions, and you correlate their health record for a certain period of time, and you see these statistical correlations. And there's been a lot of positive ones. Occasionally, the negative ones pop up. As if you do enough statistical research, you find the outliers, and that makes the news much more than, yeah, it's fine for you. So I don't know exactly what it is about it that does it, but I would, the study that you're citing is very similar to pretty much all the general statistical correlations that have been studied. Why? People aren't quite sure. It's just a statistical anomaly that they haven't yet figured out the exact reason why.
When I first joined a company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and I was assigned to the engineering and production division, where there was this great big open area of about 30 desks and 30 electronic engineers, each sitting at those desks. In the morning, every one of them had a cup of coffee or two. And woe be those people. If the coffee machine broke down, boy, it was a lot of screaming and hollering. Those people were really dependent on it. I noticed this because there was one human being in that group, me, who never acquired the taste for coffee. I just didn't like it, didn't drink it. And so I'm noticing all these other people being so heavily dependent on this substance. Let me drop. And for a long time, I had no clear explanation for what's going on. I was noticing all these coffee drinkers because I was a non-coffee drinker. Well, about a year ago, I went for one of these genetic studies called 23andMe. They looked at my genetics and made predictions. One of the predictions that evidence in my genes is that I would not be a coffee drinker. Apparently, that is predictable. Something about my ancestry created a group of genes such that I don't like coffee, or just don't seek it. And so, who would? Apparently, it's quite rare among the employees at that company, which had at the time 2,000 employees. I may have been the only one. So maybe it's kind of rare. I bet you don't know very many non-coffee drinkers, Roy, AC2GS, K2IW. Have you ever met one?
Well, I've met many people that go for long periods of their life with no interest whatsoever in drinking coffee. I think my nephew was something like 32, 33 years old before he started to drink it with vague regularity, probably not even that much. I myself, though, didn't particularly care for coffee until my internship. It was just a pretty useful crutch for those 36-hour shifts.
That sounds very unhealthy. Were you literally forced on multiple occasions to work a 36 continuous hour shift with not even a nap in between? Isn't that getting you close to the threshold where the brain starts seeing hallucinations?
Well, the theory at the time was that, supposedly, that it taught you to almost reflectively be a good doctor, where you didn't even have to think about it. It was basically slave wages, and it was made illegal. There was a very, very big case in Manhattan in a hospital where someone caused the premature death of a reporter's daughter, and he kind of ripped City Hall, and they changed the law. So you can't do the 36 hours anymore. But, this is kind of goes back to the ancient attitude of, you put yourself into semi-slavery to learn a trade. I remember one time where I went to my resident. I was an intern, and I showed him a temper dot, the thermometer, and it showed that the person was, I think, 104 degrees, and the guy said, "Well, what do you want from me? Culture the guy up." So I pulled that off my sleeve, and I said, "Fine, culture me up. I'm dying of the flu here." And, you know, it's the middle. You had to work long hours. What can I say?
What does the word culture the guy up mean? I'm not familiar with that slang, Roy. Go ahead.
Usually when someone has a fever in a hospital where you don't have a good sense of the site of the infection, you draw blood cultures. And you put them off to the side, and after a few days you examine them, see what kind of organism and what kind of resistance they're having. And usually, depending upon how sick the person looks, you either start them on a more broad-spectrum antibiotic. In my case, it was a viral syndrome, so it wouldn't have done anything. But that's what we used to call culture someone up. It was blood cultures primarily. They would also do urine analysis and a urine culture because it's a very common hospital-acquired infection.
Roughly on how many occasions were you and your internship forced to work a 36-hour shift? Did that happen 3 times or 30 times, Roy? Go ahead.
Well, it was... usually, if you were lucky, you could sneak away for a half hour or an hour and take naps. You know, back and forth. But the problem is that when you were on call and the next day wasn't a weekend that you got the weekend off, you came in at 9 o'clock in the morning, you worked through the night, and then 9 o'clock the following morning, you had to run with the rest of the interns until 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock at night, and you signed out your patients and you left. So this was unfortunately a very common thing back in the old days.
As an engineer, I only ran into that sort of a situation on 2 occasions. Lucky for me, I was the causative agent. I was analyzing a deep, expensive problem they had out at the Edwards Air Force Base anechoic chamber. And so I first worked with the day shift and then continued working through the night shift. And because of their security system procedure, there was a special badge you had to use in that area. Because the badge hadn't been recovered in the first 8-hour period, from their point of view, the badge was stolen or missing, and they created a great big search to find that badge. And I may have told you the story about how they finally found it on me at the end of the second shift. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Well, I take it you volunteered for that. It was kind of a given. You kind of expect it to be abused because that was part of your education. And if they didn't abuse you, then what was the point of the exercise? But to tell you the truth, what I hated more than the 36 shifts, because you could get a little nap here, a little nap there, and it just kind of reset you anyway, it was when I did my rotation through the emergency room, and they had 8-hour shifts. And at one point or another, I was stuck with working from midnight to 8 a.m. And it just disrupted my entire biological clock. It was the worst experience I had in the hospital.
I'm guessing that sometimes when you're working in the emergency room at 2 o'clock in the morning on a Friday night or a Saturday night, a major accident somewhere occurs and you get a whole lot of heavily injured people suddenly coming in. My guess is you can be really overwhelmed in a situation like that. And do they have a mechanism by which they can call up a whole lot of standby troops? Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, different rooms are set up for different degree of trauma. And I trained at Kings County and Brookdale, which was a primary trauma center. So we had trauma units. We would just summon the trauma units. The surgeons would run down, and the trauma nurses would run down, and they would kind of take them off to a trauma room off to the side. I was basically internal medicine, so people had chest pain or shortness of breath, or all kinds of very weird things. I once had a person come in at 3:30 in the morning with a headache, And I sort of, I don't know why, I asked him, why would he wait until 3 in the morning to come into an emergency room for a headache? And he just looked at me and he said, because it didn't stop.
Yeah, you can spend an awful lot of time saying that the how I feel is pretty bad, but not quite bad enough to go to the emergency room. And you sit and wait and hope it's going to get better. At some particular point, you suddenly realize, hey, this is intolerable. And you're not watching the clock necessarily. To a person who feels sick, or to a person who's working crazy shifts, there's nothing very magic about 3 o'clock in the morning versus 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So his quick explanation makes a little bit of sense to me, Roy. Go ahead.
Yeah, it had a wonderful internal logic to it, and I didn't give the guy a hard time. I just kind of shrugged my shoulders and then moved on. I think we gave him 2 analgesics and had him kind of take a nap for an hour, and he felt better, and we sent him home. That was adult ambulatory. I took weird histories of people at 3 o'clock in the morning in adult ambulatory that would make for a Kurt Vonnegut book.
Maybe you should write the book.
I'm telling you, if I did, people would just say that I was copying Kurt Vonnegut. I had a woman who came with a stomach ache, and I was trying to elicit details, and all of a sudden, in the middle of getting the history, she started to say how much she's banging her stomach repeatedly, and you know, I kind of said, why would you be banging your stomach? Because you have stomach ache. Usually you don't bang your stomach when you have a stomach ache. And she had a full-blown psychotic delusion that there was something inside her stomach trying to get out.
What was the solution in that case, Roy?
I picked up the phone and called for a psych consult.
And were they eventually able to calm her down and convince her that, hey, this is not real?
They came down and they talked with her, because that's what psychiatrists tend to do, a lot of talking with her. And by the time, unfortunately, before any kind of ultimate solution was found, it was 8 o'clock in the morning and time for me to leave.
That cannot be the weirdest encounter you've ever had, but we're getting off subject. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, one of these days we'll have tales of an emergency room, but let me get back to the articles, one or two more, and then we'll give it over to Paul. For more than 18 months, the U.S. diplomats have come down with similar illnesses that include mild brain damage and hearing loss after they claim to have heard unusual sounds. The incidents began in Cuba, but reports have spread to other countries, as authorities have stepped up effort to treat any potential cases. Almost 200 people have reportedly come forward to be tested. The State Department has had little to say about the incident that began in Havana in the fall of 2016, and the resulting information vacuum that has left the door wide open for conspiracy theories and other unverified claims. For now, no one can say for certain what is happening in these cases, but it appears that U.S. diplomats are being targeted in some sort of attack that's left experts baffled. Officials believe that some unknown sonic device was being used against the victim, but other theories have emerged in the meantime. Let me drop. Some American diplomats reported hearing strange sounds, of which an audio recording was later released to the public. Symptoms varied between victims, but the list includes hearing loss, dizziness, tinnitus, balance problems, visual difficulties, headaches, fatigue, cognitive issues, and sleeping difficulties. Since then, we've seen reports of diplomats falling ill in China. On last Tuesday, the Associated Press reported that 26 Americans have been medically confirmed to have been injured in a wave of these incidents, and diplomats who have served in at least 7 cities in 4 countries have sought testing. Nearly 200 employees from the U.S. diplomatic mission and their family members have elected to take part in a new screening program that U.S. officials speaking anonymously told the AP is part of an abundance of caution. Of those Americans, fewer than a dozen were said to have been transported to the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia for further review by medical personnel. Let me drop. The AP described a previously unreported incident that had officials worried about President Trump's recent visit with Kim Jong-un. As President Donald Trump was heading to Singapore for a historic summit with North Korea's leader, a State Department diplomat security agent who was part of the advance team reported hearing an unusual sound that he believed was similar to that experienced by U.S. diplomats in Cuba and China, who later fell ill. The agent immediately underwent medical screening, part of a new U.S. government protocol established to respond to such potential health incidents anywhere in the world. The president was flying to the Southeast Asian city-state. The U.S. delegation was preparing for his arrival and was exchanging urgent messages with the State Department headquarters back in Washington, including the agency's diplomatic security and the U.S. Secret Service. Let me drop. Four U.S. officials told the AP that it turned out to be a false alarm. But there is a heightened awareness among security officials as the White House prepares to meet with Russia's President Vladimir Putin later this month. Suspicions of Russian involvement in the attack were raised last September when an unnamed USAID officer and his wife were flown out of Tashkent to Uzbekistan for evaluation after they reported events that echoed what happened in Havana. The State Department later said that it isn't going to discuss every case individually, but confirmed that there is no incident in Uzbekistan. At this point, the only medically confirmed cases have occurred with diplomats stationed in Cuba and one stationed in China. Let me drop. The U.S. has issued an alert warning Americans traveling to China to seek medical attention if they experience auditory sensory phenomena, similar to that was reported in Havana, and the State Department recommended anyone traveling to Cuba should reconsider their plans. Since reporters first blindsided spokeswoman Heather Nauert with questions about the incident last August, the State Department has been reluctant to give on-the-record details about this investigation. It still refers to these cases as specific attacks without saying what is specifically happening. We've seen numerous theories for what could cause these kinds of symptoms floating around for the last year, including weaponized microwaves or radio waves and malfunctioning surveillance gear. Let me drop. The fact that they don't know how the attacks occurred tends to obscure the fact that we don't know why they're occurring in the first place. What does seem to be clear is that authorities are so concerned that they are rushing to address any potential incident that arises, and the longer the mystery goes on, the diplomats abroad are only more susceptible to private fears of that they may become a victim. So what is this all about? Is this some sinister work of some foreign adversary? Is it mass hysteria? Or is it the first signs of an impending space alien invasion? Well, stay tuned as the story progresses. Let me drop for questions or comments. Disease, cultural change wiped out pre-contact populations. Dogs might be man's best friend, but European dogs were certainly not friendly to their Native American counterparts. But don't worry, the native dogs left a going-away present on their way out. The first humans to populate the Americas arrived from Siberia via the Bering Land Bridge about 16,000 years ago. Man's best friend, the domesticated dog, didn't arrive for another 6,000 years to avoid the land bridge's collapse. But archaeological evidence suggests that the two species lived in harmony for thousands of years. Well, at least until 1492, the year Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Let me drop. According to a study published in Science recently, pre-contact American dogs possessed a unique genetic signature derived not from the North American wolf, as was previously thought, but from domesticated Siberian ancestors. Today, that singular genome has all but disappeared, eradicated by the 15th century arrival of the European settlers and their canine companions. The present explanation is that European dogs, like their human owners, probably carried diseases that pre-contact dogs were unequipped to fend off. The colonists preferred European breeds and discouraged their pets from mating with the native dogs, which were viewed as wild and vicious. Let me drop. To trace the story of these pre-contact dogs, researchers studied DNA found in the mitochondria of 81 North American and Siberian dog bones. The remains, which dated from roughly 10,000 years ago to 1,000 years ago, included those of the so-called Costa dogs, a group of four domesticated canines discovered at a burial site in western Illinois during 1970s. The Costa pups lived about 10,000 years ago, making them the oldest known dogs in the Americas. The animals had small, slender stature and could have been used as hunting dogs. DNA analysis allows the scientists to identify pre-contact dogs' closest relatives, a group of dogs native to the Zokol Islands, a frigid Arctic site situated about 300 miles north of the Russian mainland. These dogs were the first to be bred for a specific purpose, namely pulling their human sleds. Let me drop. In addition to shedding light on the first American dog's origins, the study offers insights on pre-contact dogs' connections, or rather, lack of connections, with modern dogs. Researchers compared the 71 ancient genomes with DNA from more than 5,000 modern dogs, including breeds like Chihuahuas and Carolina dogs, which are commonly thought to be descended from the indigenous population. The highest level of pre-contact DNA conclusively found in any of these modern dogs was 4%, a negligible result. The team's findings suggest that modern American dogs are descended solely from Eurasian breeds introduced by European settlers. Scientists expected to find evidence of interbreeding between the pre-contact pups and the new arrivals. Instead, they realized that the native dogs had virtually vanished. Let me drop. Oddly enough, scientists found that the closest surviving trace of pre-contact dog DNA is found in a sexually transmitted canine cancer. The disease, known as canine transmissible venereal tumor, stems from the genetic mutation of a single North American dog that lived up to 1,225 years ago. The tumor cells spread through the mating and carry a copy of that original DNA, allowing the researchers to paint a clear picture of the founding dog or patient zero. So they had their say at the end. Let me drop for questions or comments. Okay, guys, it's 11 o'clock. I think it's time for the SpaceNet. So thank you very much for listening and participating.
You might want to repeat your email addresses for reports and or that beautiful page of yours. There's a nice great list of interesting email addresses to go to. Hope you, Paul. Here we go. Roy.
Yes, indeed, Dick. Excellent idea. The email address, again, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. That's mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. And the website is roy.ac2gs.com. I have some links already up, and I will put the rest of them up in the next 10, 15 minutes. And again, if anyone has any questions or any topics that they would like me to cover, or any recent news they'd like me to focus on, or they like the biographies that I occasionally do, or they like the puzzles that I occasionally do, or they don't like them, please give me some input so that I could better shape this for everyone's enjoyment. So this is AC2GS, and thank you very much, Dick, for the opportunity.
Yeah, think about giving us one puzzle in the next week, Roy. Let's see how that goes over. Paul, WS2N, if Andy is still awake, we ought to start off and let him ask his question. To the A2CDL, are you still there, Andy? K2RIW?
Yeah, but I'm watching the news. I can't talk right now.
Okay, we'll let you break in later. So, Paul, I hope you had a chance to see 60 Minutes tonight, a very nice second presentation on the subject of Voyager. And that's one hell of a spacecraft. Of the zillions of things that NASA has done, the Hubble Space Telescope is number one, and I think Voyager number one and two is the second most important thing that NASA has ever done. WS2N on the Space Report, which is going to be Space Report number 705, if I got it. No. 17. Here we go. 306. I think this is going to be space report number 306. You got a bolt, KQRIW.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, 306. This is WS2N. And, yeah, okay, Andy's watching the news. That's okay. We'll be here until 12. And, Voyager, well, yeah, we talked about it a little bit before, but I gave out that website, and they have everything on that website. It's improved over the last couple of years, and you can click on different things and find out all about the spacecraft, all about where it is, where it's going, and that was a question that N2EO had going out to Alpha Centauri. You're correct, it's not going in that direction, but the next time it will come near a star, any star, and this goes for both of them, we'll be around, even though they're going in different directions, we'll be about 40,000 years from now. So what the Egyptians with the pyramids was a couple of thousand years ago, 4,000 years ago. So 10 times that amount. It'll be coming within a light year, 1.7 light years, to a pretty much unnamed or little-known star. One's going out by the Little Dipper, and the other one is going out to another constellation. Let me drop it. So we're not going to worry about Voyagers for a while, but they're doing good. They have fuel on board, hydrazine fuel still that they use to correct its orientation once in a while to make sure the antenna is pointing to Earth. And the thrusters that they were using over all these decades were starting to show signs of problems. They had to be on longer to do the same amount of work that they used to do. So they decided about a year or so ago to let's try using four different thrusters that they haven't used in 37 years. On Voyager 1, and when it passed Saturn, that was the last planet for Voyager 1, they used the thrusters for the last time. 37 years later, they said, let's try them again, and maybe we can use that to correct the attitude of the spaceship. Leave it on for like microseconds. They did that, and over 19 hours later, they got an answer that everything was fine. By the way, that's the one-way trip now, 19 hours for Voyager 1, a little bit less, 17 for Voyager 2. So, that's it, and hopefully it'll keep on going. They expect the RTG radioisotope thermoelectric generator to keep on going for many more years. Right now, they said the latest on that website that wattage output was 245 on the, that's what the RTG is putting out. So a lot of stuff is shut down. They need the power to run some of the heaters for these thrusters that they're using. Now that it works so good on Voyager 1, they're thinking about using it on Voyager 2 as well. But Voyager 2's primary thrusters are still working. So that's the deal for Voyager. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about a new launch date that's been set for the James Webb Space Telescope. It's now March 30th of 2021, so they have had their problems over the years. It's been in the making since, 1995 or so. When they used to call it, they didn't have a name for the space telescope at the time. It was called the Next Generation Space Telescope. And then eventually it got the name James Webb. James Webb, one of the original directors of NASA back in the manned space program. And they named it after him, and it's supposed to be $500 million. We're up to almost $10 billion, and many years later. Should have been launched, 2016. The next date now is 2021 in March. and it's still supposed to be launched on the Ariane 5 spacecraft.